Accession number 29957, Reel 2.
You mentioned that you were all rearing to go.
Mm.
Did you have any concerns initially?
No, not really. Because I was joining on the ground staff, so one of the prime ministers, I don't know who it was at the time, well, I mean, Menzies, it could have been anybody, he referred to the air crew as the cream of Australia's youth, which in fact they were, but they weren't all the cream. I mean, some of the cream escaped into other and some of the other services.
Why were you so interested in the Air Force at this stage, do you think?
Well, I've always been interested in the air. When I was quite young, I used to spend a lot of time at the Maylands Aerodrome. I'd catch a bus into town and then a tram out to Bayswater or somewhere like that, and then walk for a couple of miles to get to the Maylands Aerodrome. These were in the days of the before the war, where they had the Hercules flying across Australia in leaps and bounds. I mean, they couldn't go too far without having to land and refuel. Vickersby Astral, which was a tragedy, I think, and lots of small aeroplanes, mainly Gypsy Moths. And then there's a fellow called Ittershagen who had a cane factory in West Subiaco, just opposite the West Subiaco railway station. And he bought a block of land out behind the asylum and decided he'd have an aerodrome. This is before the war, of course, and he imported two German Klemm monoplanes, and there are a lot of de Havilland Moths and one thing or another, or a lot, when I say a lot, four or five of them, as well as those two Moths. The monoplanes, the Klemms, and well, they used to put on shows out there and on the aerodrome. But then the whole of the earth changed when it became compulsory for them to have dual ignition, and those aeroplanes were just more or less wheeled into the hangar and left there because of the engines, and nobody seemed to have the money or want to put a new engine into them. The hangars were just shut up and left, but the vandals got at it and lifted one sheet of iron, of galvanised iron, galvanised iron, which the place was made of, and they just lift one corner of it and crawl through. Well, I did that one day. I lifted the corner of it and pulled and went through it, and in the office there was a beautiful scale model of a Gypsy Moth, and I thought I'd look like that, and I would have a look in the hangars themselves, and all the wings of these airplanes had been stomped through. They were just a ragged mess. And on the way out I grabbed that model and took it home, and I thought, now what am I going to do with this? If I take it inside there, it was too good for a toy. It was really factory made. My mum and dad'll want to know where I got it from and all about it, and one thing and another. So I said, oh, I'll hide it under the house. It was a brick house, the war service home, but we'd had a long veranda built across the back of it with another sleep out in that. And you could get underneath the wooden part, not under the brick foundations. So I took it under there and hid it. And I said, well, what's the good of this? I've got the model aeroplane, I can't bring it inside, I can't, it's no good and hidden under there. So I went back and put it back again. And that was the end of that one. But there was no more flying there then. They did change it into a dirt track for a while. I used to raise motor cars and motorbikes and one thing or another, but it was a pretty rough old track. And today that ground is a part of the, I think it's the university sports oval. It's quite a nicely grassed area now. And well, that was the fact that I was always interested in them, and I used to make them out of cardboard and have dog fights with them, you know. They were good little models. And I made one big one that was going to fly, was supposed to fly, but I made it out of, I didn't know much about what you could get or anything like that. I made it out of a Rangoon cane. I bound all the joints together and glued it. It was quite a 3 foot wide wingspan, I suppose, and quite big. And I did put in for an apprenticeship at the Midland Workshops. That's where my father, he served time there. He worked there for quite a few years. And I took this, he said, I'll take your model up and show them that, what you've done. But it didn't impress them because it was just the cane, didn't have any coating on it at all. I didn't get the apprenticeship, but I'm not sorry because I finished up better off by taking on the printing.
You mentioned, obviously, your friends are pretty keen to get involved.
Yes.
To what degree do you think there was a sense of adventure that people wanted to?
Oh, it was adventure that they were after. It wasn't the thought of getting killed or the danger of it. It was just adventure that they were after. As I see it, later on it might have been a case of people thinking they should be involved or something like that. I don't know, but they certainly didn't have any trouble recruiting for the AIF and for the various services. They could fill them as quick as they wanted. I don't know what else I can say about that area. There are probably things that I've missed out.
That's all right. I wanted to talk to you, obviously, about how you came to be involved in the Air Force and what was the process? How did you get involved?
Well, it all started when I was quite young. Somebody gave me a book. It might have been the Boy's Own Annual or something like that. I don't know what it was. But it was a big annual book that they put out. And this had a couple of stories in it. One of them was The Mystery of the Branks and Downs. Well, it was an English book. And this Mystery of the Branks and Grounds was a ship with dozens and dozens of helicopter rotors. Instead of the structure of a ship, it had flat deck and all these rotors sticking up, and it was going to fly. But it didn't fly. I don't know what happened to it in the long run. But in that book there was a lovely colour plate of three Bristol Bulls. Colour plate, you know, colour was pretty expensive in printing in those days, but there was a really good photograph of these three Bristol Bulldogs in a shallow dive, you know, going down like this. And I thought that was bloody wonderful. And a bit later on, I don't know how much later, but later on those three Bristol Bulldogs came to Perth from the eastern states, and they flew from the west to the east right up Murray Street. You could see them, follow them right along Murray Street, and I saw those, and it was my ambition to fly one of those. And Well, I did join up, and I went to number one engineering school, and I joined up on the ground staff, and I went to number one, well, Ascot Vale, which was number one engineering school at the time. They had one of these bulldog spiders there, and I thought that it wasn't flying, that it was only there for instructional purposes, and it looked beautiful to me. But by that time, of course, they were outdated. There wouldn't be any of them flying in the Second World War.
So when the Second World War came about, how did you get in to the Air Force?
Well, I just went down, as I said, the day it started, and the day they opened the day the war started, I went down and put my name down at Perth Tech. And because I wanted 2 weeks notice, I wasn't called up until I went and withdrew that requirement for 2 weeks, and I was in pretty quickly after that. But that was the 4th or the 5th in 1940. We, at that stage, there were a quite a big shipment of us, or draft of us from Perth. We got on the Kalgoorlie Express, or whatever they call it, and when we got to Kalgoorlie, there's another mob of Kalgoorlieites joined us, and so we were all on this. We got on the Australian Railways there in civilian trains. We all went as over in our civilian unit, in our civvy clothes, and as civilians. We were fed the same as the passengers and all the rest, but there must have been a couple of hundred of us anyhow, at least. And we went straight through we had to change trains at Gustrop, I think it was. We changed trains there, and there we were put into carriages with six aside, and it was pretty crowded.
Did you have to have any credentials to get into the Air Force at that point?
Oh, yes. Well, you're supposed to. For instance, my brother, who was in the motor game all these, with my the second eldest, or the middle brother, he had all his life was tied up with cars, motorbikes in particular. They used to race motorbikes, and they knew the whole thing back to front, but I knew all the parts because they used to get me to pull them to pieces and clean them, but I never had any experience of putting them together, and it made me wonder. But he went in straight as a flight sergeant, a trainee. No, not trainee. You'd have to go and do the usual engineering course as a fitter 2E, and he was very quickly became a flight sergeant 2E, which is quite an achievement. My other brother, he used to race motorbikes too, but he'd served in the voluntary Navy. We used to live in Fremantle at that stage, and he was in the Navy, and he was a chief petty officer when he left. And when the war started, he put his name down, and because at that time they were taking all the prominent yachtsmen in Perth, all the the big wigs of Perth. They were taking them straight into, as commissioned officers, straight into the Navy. And of course, because Bernard had been a chief petty officer, they took him too. And that was easy. But with me, in the motorbikes and cars, I couldn't understand the basics. I mean, they talked about the magneto or the generator or something, and twiddling this coil inside a magnet. All right, you do that, but where does it start? What is it? And nobody could tell me that. And also, if the piston goes up an explosion or combustion sends it down, what makes it come up again? And all these things, I even got, when I was put my name down from the Air Force, my brother used to work in a in Atkins in Perth, which is a you know, metal car parts place, and they had all kinds of repair shops and everything like that, and he got me a couple of days in these shops, a couple of days in the electrical section and a couple of days in the carburetor section, and they couldn't tell me why the spark was there, and they must have thought I was silly or something. They couldn't tell me why the bloody piston came up again, and I never learned that at all until I went to engineering school, and the first lesson I had, it's simple, with a spark that cannot be explained, it just happens and nobody knows how it happens or what causes it. And as far as the piston coming up again, that was the counterbalance that they've got in the flywheel. And they were simple things just explained like that, but they couldn't get down to my level in these other places where they had men working on them all day long.
But I wanted to know, was it difficult for you to get into the Air Force?
No. I can't remember what questions they asked me. I think I just applied to be a flight mechanic and a trainee flight mechanic, and that was it. And they took me, as they took everybody, did that 3 months training in a magnificent course. But they compressed so much into that 3 months that you got all the basics. You got more than the basics because you went through two or three different kinds of engines, like the radial engine, the inline engine, and the sleeve valve engine, and all these things. They were all explained to you. You did a bit of filing and shaping and this kind of thing. Like, for instance, you had a little oblong block about that big in metal, which was be about 30 millimetres thick. About 25 millimetres. No, it's not that. About 15 millimetres. I would have said a quarter of an inch or 3/8 of an inch thick. And you had to cut a square out of that, or another little oblong out of the middle of that. And you have to file it down to accurate, and then you have to get another bit of stuff and cut that and file it down to fit exactly into that block. This was all good experience, and they compressed these courses into 3 and 6 months, and you came out and you were capable of doing the things you had to do. I mean, as a flight mechanic, our job was to look after the aircraft in the actual operating aircraft, but it was all in training schools. I mean, I went to, I had apparently been typed as a cheetah man, which was, the cheetah was the engine that powered the Ansons and Airspeed Oxfords, and I went to Wagga onto the Ansons up there, and our duty was to, do daily inspections. Each day you had to do certain things, like check the petrol and check a number of other things, and then after 10 hours you'd have to do something a little bit more thorough than that, and then at I think it was 5 hours and 10 hours you had these different inspections, but they stretched them to 10 and 15 and probably even beyond that after my time. But I went there, and then I was posted to Geraldton as once again on the ground staff on cheetahs, and I was there for some time, and then this time I the commanding officer, or the air officer commanding, a fellow called De La Rue, came up to inspect the... He was the air... The officer in charge of Western Command, as far as the Air Force was concerned. He came up there and he put out a notice to say anybody with a complaint to prayed before him, or come up and interview him, or be interviewed, whatever, why you look at it. And because lots of fellas wanted to go up, and they all got into their blues and polished their shoes and spick and span themselves up and up the way to De La Rue to put their case. When my turn came, I went up there in my greasy overalls and Tammy hat on, and this was just, I was very naive in those days. I was naive when I went to the squadron too. Anyhow, I went up like that, and I told him I wanted to get in the aircrew, and he said, oh, but you know, I don't think you can do that. And I said, well, that's what I want. And he said, look, what about if you become a fitter 2E? And I said, well, at the moment there's no avenue open for me to become a fitted 2E. It's just not on. I can progress to a leading aircraftsman, and that's as far as I can go in this mustering. And he said, oh, let's see about that. And anyhow, eventually they did allow you to remuster to a fitted 2E. You'd go back and do an extra course. But I said, well, it's not what I want anyhow. I want to get into aircrew. And he said, well, I don't know whether that can be done or not, but I'll check into it, I'll look into it for you. Now, I got three signals from the air officer commanding De La Rue to me, AC-1 Tanger at Jordan. Three things tell me what he'd done, one after the other. And the final one was that he looked into it as far as he could go, and there is no avenue for me to bring us to into aircrew. But that did some good, I'm quite sure, because when just soon after he went, I was posted back to the engineering school, and I did bring muster to a fitter 2E. But then again, I was posted to Malala on Cheetahs again. And from there I was posted back to Geraldton on Cheetahs. And from Geraldton, eventually I was posted to Ascot to Lavett and into engine repair section there. And I was there for 10 months. But while I was at the engineer school the second time, there was just a rumour went around that they were going to allow some green staff to remuster into aircrew. Another fellow and myself called George Lee Mercier, we both had the same ideas, and as soon as we heard this, we rushed down to the orderly office and got a blue form. Now, the blue form was for remuster to aircrew, or to join aircrew it was. And I mean, it was the form that anybody who was going into aircrew used to fill in before the remusters came was allowed, but it was the same form, it didn't matter. We rushed down and we got a form, quickly filled it in and took it back down there. And a few days later, the warrant officer in charge of the parade and everything like that, He read this out in the daily routine orders that some people were going to be allowed to join aircrew or remuster to aircrew, because after there's over 5,000 blokes in that thing, and there must have been 2,500 went down and got a form, filled it in, flooded the orderly room, because the orderly room had two of them up and put it through in the bloody bin. But ours had moved on, and we got our call up for aircrew. We went down We didn't actually get the call up then, but we did do our examination for it then. We both passed as fit. We had to do a physical and medical and one thing or other. Both of us were passed fit and able, and 3 months later George Lemercier died. So I got through, but poor old George didn't make it. He was flying before me. He got his wings before me. He apparently had a thing. He used to get this sore back. And there's another fellow in that place called Doug Cargee. I think his people were in real estate. Doug Cargee used to rub his back with horse liniment every night, or with some kind of a liniment, and you could smell the whole of the big building we were in. You could smell this horse liniment right through. And it turned out that George had hit his back on the propeller while out on the as a flight mechanic, you know, bending down. The thing was, we'd take bits of any pieces that we'd take off, we'd let a bucket of a 98 octane petrol out and get a bucket full, we'd wash them and clean them in that. Well, George is bending down and washing that, and he stood up and hit the propeller right in the middle of his back, and it was that that turned to cancer, or that's what they reckon. And he passed on.
That was some time after you joined up, obviously.
Yeah.
And you mentioned that you joined up in 1940, and you talked about joining up around May of 1940. Mm. Obviously, towards the end of May, we have the evacuation of British and French forces at Dunkirk, and that. Blitzkrieg. Mm. Germany invades Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, and France on the 10th of May. What were your impressions of the enemy?
Well, we knew they were very good and better equipped than our mob were, and but they were something to we'll have to contend with. Things could only improve in our view, or in my view. They couldn't get any bloody worse. They didn't even have, half of them didn't even bring their rifles back from Dunkirk. And I think about that stage the Canadians, either before or soon after, they tried a landing in the Canadian group on their own, and they were wiped out. No, we knew that there was a lot more in it than just joining up. It was going to be a battle in fact.
You and your mates ever consider that possibly the Germans might win?
Well, I think I did at different times, and I'm surprised that they didn't. It's only they could have won that war if Hitler had left them alone. He wouldn't let them shift their tanks down to where the Yanks were landing and the British were landing. And that was where he went wrong. That stuffed it up. Because after that, well, once we landed on the continent, the Germans were on their back foot then, because we had all these aircraft that we could get at them with, and our fighters could cover us and all the rest of it, and they gradually got pushed back, and it was. But still, it was never obvious that they were going to get beaten. They had that Battle of the Ardennes and or one or two others it wasn't obvious that they were beaten even at that stage. But, we also, found that it became a little bit more hopeful, a little bit more. Yes, hopeful, I suppose you'd call it, when they kicked Rommel out of the Middle East. That made a big difference. And landing in Italy, it became apparent that they were going to get beaten, but they weren't going to give up anyhow.